Good morning. On this cusp between the 2 months of Caesars, Julius, and Augustus, my name is Michael McCusker. Does anyone out there in radio land harbor an intuitive despair that these might be the prophesied end times cited in scripture and science fiction? Worldwide plagues at the onset of climate change that forecasts the probable extinction of humanity. Is this our contemporary nightmare reality? Robbers abound. People are saying we don't know what will happen from day to day. The country is spinning round and round like a potter's wheel. No more do we hear anyone laugh. The masses are like timid sheep without a shepherd. The few slay the many. Impudence is rife. Oh, that man could cease to be, that women should no longer conceive and give birth. Then, at length, the world would find peace. And that was from a screed by a scribe complaining about life in Egypt in about 2000 BC. It has a hauntingly familiar chill about it. At the very least, the rapid collapse of American civilization as we have known it should be traumatic. We are being flushed into a looming black hole by white-livered fools and cretins who masquerade as great white hopes. It seems to be the harsh old biblical saga all over again. Half as many Americans have already died from the epidemic pestilence in 6 months as were killed by bombs and bullets in 4 years of World War II. Approximately 300,000 USA KIA in that war. After all, this virus literally takes our collective breaths away. And the nation's fake president, Donald Trump, has been undone by the pandemic. He tried to hide his lethality from the American public, but quite truthfully, he has hidden from it. He is actually corona-phobic and disease-distraught overall. Trump has consistently claimed the virus will magically disappear. But just as he ducked out of the Vietnam War, he has failed his truly first major crisis test as president. Too bewildered, and you might legitimately say unmanned by his responsibility. And his words and actions have certainly exposed his most primal lack of concern for anyone but himself. Perhaps if his infectious fears are realized, he will literally die away and the rest of Americans remaining alive will have a decent prospect of survival. Or we will simply have to wait and hope we live long enough to vote in November. This summer, Oregon's own Portland is at the whirling vortex of federal insurrection, which is an irony of sorts because the city is commemorating two nationally infamous anti-Vietnam War demonstrations of 50 years ago. The first occurred May 11, 1970, when Portland police attacked Portland State student protesters and a few anti-war Vietnam veterans, now known as Bloody Monday. Except that is also the historic date in 1792, when Boston Captain Robert Gray crossed the bar into the river he named after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Reborn. The second commemoration will be in late August, the People's Army Jamboree confrontation with the annual American Legion Convention, which had been feared to be violent as a result of a visit by then-President Richard Nixon, who canceled. The first state-sponsored rock festival was held to prevent the very same street strife now occurring in Portland between federal agents and local citizens who are very angry the national government is invading their city. That long-ago peace festival at MacIver State Park in August 1970 was called Vortex. August this year not only observes the 75th anniversaries of the use of the atomic bombs against two Japanese cities and the resulting end of World War II in 1945, but also nuclear explosion of urban riot within the black ghetto of Watts this month, 55 years ago in 1965, from August 11th to the 16th. At the time, Watts was the most severe outbreak of public insurrection since the Civil War a century earlier. It started as riots usually do in black ghettos. Police beat a black man in the Watts section of Los Angeles, and in this case, family and neighbors rushed to the rescue. The first couple of days and nights escalated with crowds rampaging, looting, and burning, followed by shooting. Police and National Guard responded with heavy firepower. Firefighters were forced to retreat or avoid fires because of violence and incapacity to respond to so many. Entire city blocks were on fire, as in the later Central Los Angeles riot in 1992 in the same part of the city. And similarly, non-black owned or operated liquor stores and other businesses were torched and looted. Riots are terrible to witness. Exposure to mass rage and violence, whatever the cause, is terrifying, whether a witness feels sympathy or abhors it. The intensity of mass rage, the inward turn of it even as it lashes out randomly, the howl that roars from the crowd, a huge shriek of pain despite the individual epithets of anger, like eating one's own liver, as someone once expressed it. In Watts, crowds of blacks mauled their own neighborhoods, inflicted destruction and homelessness upon themselves, most of whom were trapped within the hysteria, as they were 28 years later in the larger outbreak against police violence in 1992, caused by LA police beating Rodney King. Six clubs beat a king was a joke. The death toll in 1992 exceeded Watts, but the numbers of black persons killed and injured in both Watts and Central LA 1992 were grossly minimalized in official body counts. So many were dead and wounded from police and National Guard gunfire and baton beatings that city parks became temporary morgues and hospitals, and prison booking facilities were also set up in parks because of the overflow of arrested. In regards to Watts, many arrested males were given choice of jail or, quote, service to their country, unquote, in Vietnam. The great fear of everybody in either Watts or 1992 was the possibility of a white backlash from the surrounding suburbs, which would ignite a bloody race war, which might occur right now in 2020 in Louisville, Kentucky, with armed white and black militias facing each other while federal marshals invade the city, as in Portland. Both Los Angeles riots, Detroit, Michigan, and Liberty City, Florida riots have been considered the 20th century's worst black riots in the USA. But the Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre of whites slaughtering blacks in June 1921 is yet the worst ever, except for the fact it cannot be blamed on black insurrection, as all the other urban violence is. Yet all of them flared as a result of treatment by police. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they are foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, as Thomas Jefferson noted in the Declaration of Independence, people will patiently endure the iron heel, but an excessive act of brutality, such as kneeling on the neck of a black man or police savagely clubbing another black man, can be a final indignity that erupts in thermonuclear reaction to the usual racism and enforced poverty and miserable living conditions endured by most black citizens of the USA. The unending bitter enmity between blacks and whites brings to mind an old joke that optimists believe we live in the best of all possible worlds, and that pessimists agree. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, Dangerous Times. These are dangerous times. Never have so many people had so much access to information and yet been so resistant to learning anything. Otherwise, intelligent people are denigrating intellectual achievement and rejecting the advice of experts. Not only do increasing numbers of lay people lack basic knowledge, they reject fundamental rules of evidence and refuse to learn how to make a logical argument. In doing so, they risk throwing away centuries of accumulated knowledge and undermining the practices and habits that allow us to develop new knowledge. I'm afraid we are witnessing the death of the ideal of expertise itself. A Google-fueled collapse of any division between professionals and laypeople, students and teachers, knowers and wonderers. In other words, between those of any achievement and those with none at all. Attacks on established knowledge are sometimes amusing, sometimes even hilarious. Late-night comedians have created a cottage industry of asking people questions that reveal their ignorance about their own strongly held ideas, their attachment to fads, and their unwillingness to admit their own cluelessness about current events. It's mostly harmless when people emphatically say, for example, that they're avoiding gluten and then have to admit that they have no idea what gluten is. When life and death are involved, however, it's a lot less funny. When uninformed celebrities seize on myths and misinformation, say, about the dangers of vaccines, millions of people could once again be in serious danger from preventable afflictions like measles and whooping cough. But the growth of that kind of stubborn ignorance can't be explained away as merely the result of rank ignorance. Many people who campaign against established knowledge are otherwise adept. In some ways, it's all worse than ignorance. It is unfounded arrogance, the outrage of an increasingly narcissistic culture that can't endure even the slightest hint of inequality of any kind. When I say the death of expertise, I don't mean the death of actual expert abilities or the knowledge of specific things that set some people apart from others in various areas. There will always be doctors and diplomats, lawyers and engineers, and other specialists in various fields. The world can't function without them. If you break a bone or get arrested, you call a doctor or a lawyer. When you travel, you take it for granted the pilot knows how planes work. We rely on experts as technicians, but the use of established knowledge only goes so far. Stitch the cut in my leg, but don't lecture me about my diet. More than two-thirds of Americans are overweight. Help me with my tax problem, but don't remind me I should have a will. Roughly half of Americans with children have written one. Keep my country safe, but don't confuse me with the costs and calculations of national security. Most U.S. citizens don't have a clue about how much the United States spends on its armed forces. All those choices require a conversation between citizens and experts. But increasingly, citizens don't seem to want the conversation. They would rather believe they have enough information to make these decisions on their own, insofar as they care about making any of those decisions at all. On the other hand, many experts have abandoned their duty to engage with the public, retreating into jargon and preferring to interact only with each other. The death of expertise isn't just a rejection of existing knowledge. It's a rejection of science and rationality, the foundations of modern civilization. We have come full circle, with folk wisdom filling gaps in knowledge. Any assertion of expertise from an actual expert may produce an explosion of anger from people who claim that such claims are little more than fallacious appeals to authority or sure signs of elitism, or an obvious attempt to stifle a dialogue required of real Americans, who now believe that having equal rights also means that each person's opinion about anything must be accepted as equal to anyone else's. That's obvious nonsense, but remains a credo of many people. It's a flat assertion of actual equality that's always illogical, sometimes funny, and often dangerous. Attacks on established knowledge have a long pedigree, and the internet is only the most recent tool in a recurring problem that in the past misused television, radio, the printing press, and other innovations the same way. Maybe, however, the death of expertise is a sign of progress. Educated professionals, after all, no longer have a stranglehold on knowledge. It wasn't that long ago when most people didn't finish high school, when very few attended college, and when only a tiny fraction of our population entered professions. During the past half century, universal education, the greater empowerment of women and minorities, and increased social mobility threw a minority of experts and the majority of citizens into direct contact. Yet the result hasn't been a greater respect for knowledge, but the growth of an irrational conviction among Americans that everyone is as smart as everyone else. That is the opposite of education, which should aim to make people, no matter how smart or accomplished they are, learners for the rest of their lives. Rather, we now live in a society where the acquisition of even a little learning is the end point rather than the beginning of education, and that is a dangerous thing. And that was Dangerous Times by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. And now, this past Sunday, July 26th, was the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. That year, 1990, Arthur Honeyman, who was born with cerebral palsy, celebrated his 50th birthday. He once wrote, "I am a spastic. I am a freak. My body shakes like four winds tearing at it from all points of the compass. My speech is tortured almost to being incomprehensible. I drool and vomit almost uncontrollably. I cannot even write without laboriously dictating to someone. I have to be cared for like a six-month-old baby. But my mind is free. I am a scholar, a poet, and teacher. I am a freak and sometimes an embarrassment to others, but not to myself. Living within this shaking body, however fettered it may seem, is to me the most natural way of living because it is the only life I have known." And that was something Arthur Honeyman wrote. And Arthur wrote the following polemic through stuttering dictation about the same time the ADA became law. "If Criminals Don't Shape Up" by Arthur Honeyman. If cripples don't shape up, they must die. Cripples will scorn this statement while lackadaisically lapping up welfare. They don't realize that the heyday for cripples is rapidly coming to a close, and that only a constant struggle for survival will preserve their race as being useful to humanity. The fact of the matter is that Darwin was right after all. Survival of the fittest is the rule of the universe. On Earth, Homo sapiens is a communal form of life, and in their eternal quest for more community, have destroyed the rest of the planet and accepted the cripple into their community as a necessary scapegoat, thus promoting their self-image as collectively compassionate. Perhaps this is part of a long-range evolutionary process, and perhaps natural selection is taking place. But humanity is racing toward self-extinction and extinction of a whole earthly colony. Through genetics, the cripple will probably be extinguished mercifully. But suppose the cripple is actually an evolutionary link to a future, non-physical essence floating around the universe, as propounded in the fantasy The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. If this is true, the cripple does have a purpose. If this is true, genetic control will only mean the ultimate stagnation of the so-called progression of the human being. Through genetic control, humanity will stop its own existence. So the idea is to perpetuate all possibilities of the future of the planet and the human race. The idea is to persuade the rest of humanity that the cripple is essential to the creative continuation of life on Earth and future unknown space. Human beings will not understand this long-range quest. Rather, most humans will view the immediate situation, the overpopulation of the world, and utilitarian needs of the present and the not-too-distant future. So the cripple needs to get off his and her butt and prove useful to the human existence right now, rather than being a Christian burden to be endured for the love and blood of Christ, quote-unquote, or Allah, Buddha, etc. The cripple must stop sucking pariah-like and its linguistic connotations, confirming the liberal Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, etc. tradition that certain members of humanity need to be classified in a have a pity on, quote-unquote, category. Parenthetical interjection. There is no more space on earth. Someone must die. The ancients were right after all. Cripples must be blood sacrificed onto the rocks, into the soil, to the future growth of olive trees and the final tranquility of humankind. It is 1984, and warfare is out of the question. Blood sacrifice is barbaric and has sunk into the anomaly of non-symbol and non-myth. Psychology has therapeutically drained sorrow and compassion from the human essence into a strictly existential satisfaction. The cripple must die because there is no room for cripples. They must die bloodlessly because humanity doesn't recognize that cripples have blood or muscles or sexual potency. The human race is weeded, and the cripple, a malformation and useless entity of all races, is plucked. End parenthetical interruption. Imagine the existence of the cripple and the struggle for daily survival. Imagine cripples in a semi-warfare state being cared for by that state and by their families. Imagine every day taking more than giving or contributing to the community. Imagine the lack of psychological potency. The cripple is fed, clothed, cleaned, sheltered, and is entertained by society. And what is the price? The price is being psychological butt of the community, and ultimately, after a fruitless life, death. Generally, the cripple's death is early, not just because of physical condition, quote-unquote, but also because there is nothing to live for. Generally, the cripple is an uneducated sheep, but what about the rare cripple who is educated? Educated cripples are aware of their social castration and generally acknowledge self-impotence with vapid cynicism. The realistic redneck will say about cripples, shoot them and get it over with. The liberal will give cripples welfare and continue to inculcate this cripple's castration. The enigma of the whole situation is that the so-called radical does not even seem to acknowledge the existence of cripples because, quote, everyone is crippled. Thus, the problem of what to do with cripples is a complex issue. The radicals are right. Every human being is a cripple, but society does not treat every cripple as a human being. The question is how cripples should be treated, especially if cripples don't want to be treated paternalistically, yet depend on society for daily subsistence. The whole issue is so complex and profound as to boggle and confound not only human imagination, but the history of cripples and their place in the social community as well. The question even staggers Marxian dialectics. The cripple simply does not fit into the normal scheme of things. Ask the black, the Jew, the Indian, etc. The aged have already made their contribution and generally, except in American society, are respected for it. But the cripple has no tradition of contributing in any society. Historically, children have been forced to grow into men and women by being thrown into life and exposed to its harsh realities rather than being protected. The general exception to this pattern has been cripples. Cripples have been taught from the beginning that it's not realistic to expect to go into training for future life, future usefulness, future self-sufficiency. Paradoxically, they have been trained by not being trained. Cripples in general are not just as physically capable as anyone else, but they are not trained to deal with survival as a routine reality. For example, cripples are able to accomplish phenomenal feats such as painting with a paintbrush in their mouth or between their toes, weightlift fantastic amounts of pounds with just arm strength. Those without legs can climb ladders over 100 feet high, stumps dangling in the breeze, and other grotesque yet useful feats that boggle the cultural imagination. But these people are a sideshow. They are not trained to put their capabilities to daily use in society or even separate from society. They are trained from birth to do tricks, to perform for the board, to exhibit their skills to zoo watchers. If this is a ruthless indictment, it is because even the great artists and writers have depicted the grotesque for grotesque's sake and thus have evaluated them as such. To train the cripple in the art of usefulness, a cripple is needed. A cripple not born crippled, and who has a grasp on the various subtleties and modes of survival, primordial and social. If cripples are to survive, they must act on several levels. First, they must acknowledge their past with pride. Pride because they still exist despite society. Secondly, cripples must acknowledge their past with shame. Shame because they are victims of society. Third, likewise, cripples must acknowledge their pains, joys, failures, and successes, their symbolic and real meanings. Fourth and finally, cripples must seize responsibilities that have been denied them, responsibilities they have denied themselves. Cripples must plunge into the complex morass and synthesize it to their advantage. And that was by Arthur Honeyman. If cripples don't shape up. Arthur Honeyman died 12 years ago. On December 8, 2008, on the 86th anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire of 1922, he was 68. Arthur's golden precept was, spastic power is an irrational feeling, but so is love. This is Michael McCusker. On this date, July 30th, 1974, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach President Richard Nixon for the Watergate cover-up. The plague rages in the air we breathe. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else. Wear your mask publicly and proudly.